yearning for the land and families they left behind. All of this bound America and Cuba in a unique relationship, at once family and foe. Proudly, the United States has supported democracy and human rights in Cuba through these 5 decades. We've done so primarily through policies that aim to isolate the island, preventing the most basic travel and commerce that Americans can enjoy anyplace else. And though this policy has been rooted in the best of intentions, no other nation joins us in imposing these sanctions, and it has had little effect beyond providing the Cuban government with a rationale for restrictions on its people. Today, Cuba is still governed by the Castros and the Communist Party that came to power half a century ago. Neither the American nor Cuban people are well served by a rigid policy that's rooted in events that took place before most of us were born. Consider that for more than 35 years, we've had relations with China, a far larger country also governed by a Communist Party. Nearly 2 decades ago, we reestablished relations with Vietnam, where we fought a war that claimed more Americans than any Cold War confrontation. That's why, when I came into office, I promised to re-examine our Cuba policy. As a start, we lifted restrictions for Cuban Americans to travel and send remittances to their families in Cuba. These changes, once controversial, now seem obvious. Cuban Americans have been reunited with their families and are the best possible ambassadors for our values. And through these exchanges, a younger generation of Cuban Americans has increasingly questioned an approach that does more to keep Cuba closed off from an interconnected world. While I've been prepared to take additional steps for some time, a major obstacle stood in our way: the wrongful imprisonment in Cuba of a U.S. citizen and USAID subcontractor, Alan Gross, for 5 years. Over many months, my administration has held discussions with the Cuban government about Alan's case and other aspects of our relationship. His Holiness Pope Francis issued a personal appeal to me and to Cuba's President Raul Castro, urging us to resolve Alan's...
Hey, y'all, welcome to the show. The Emperor's speaking on Cuba right now. They're opening up trade relations and ending the Cold War. Check it out.
...important intelligence agents that the United States has ever had in Cuba, and who has been imprisoned for nearly 2 decades.
He's talking about Alan Gross.
This man, whose sacrifice has been known to only a few, provided America with the information that allowed us to arrest the network of Cuban agents that included the men transferred to Cuba today, as well as other spies in the United States. This man is now safely on our shores. Having recovered these two men who sacrificed for our country, I'm now taking steps to place the interests of the people of both countries at the heart of our policy. First, I've instructed Secretary Kerry to immediately begin discussions with Cuba to reestablish diplomatic relations that have been severed since January of 1961. Going forward, the United States will reestablish an embassy in Havana, and high-ranking officials will visit Cuba. Where we can advance shared interests, we will, on issues like health, migration, counterterrorism, drug trafficking, and disaster response. Indeed, we've seen the benefits of cooperation between our countries before. It was a Cuban, Carlos Finlay, who discovered that mosquitoes carry yellow fever. His work helped Walter Reed fight it. Cuba has sent hundreds of healthcare workers to Africa to fight Ebola, and I believe American and Cuban healthcare workers should work side by side to stop the spread of this deadly disease. Now, where we disagree, we will raise those differences directly, as we will continue to do on issues related to democracy and human rights in Cuba. But I believe that we can do more to support the Cuban people and promote our values through engagement. After all, these 50 years have shown that isolation has not worked. It's time for a new approach. Second, I've instructed Secretary Kerry to review Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. This review will be guided by the facts and the law. Terrorism has changed in the last several decades. At a time when we are focused on threats from Al-Qaeda to ISIL, a nation that meets our conditions and renounces the use of terrorism should not face this sanction. Third, We are taking steps to increase travel, commerce, and the flow of information to and from Cuba. This is fundamentally about freedom and openness, and also expresses my belief in the power of people-to-people engagement. With the changes I'm announcing today, it will be easier for Americans to travel to Cuba, and Americans will be able to use American credit and debit cards on the island. Nobody represents America's values better than the American people, and I believe this contact will ultimately do more to empower the Cuban people. I also believe that more resources should be able to reach the Cuban people. So we're significantly increasing the amount of money that can be sent to Cuba and removing limits on remittances that support humanitarian projects, the Cuban people, and the emerging Cuban private sector. I believe that American businesses should not be put at a disadvantage, and that increased commerce is good for Americans and for Cubans. So we will facilitate authorized transactions between the United States and Cuba. U.S. financial institutions will be allowed to open accounts at Cuban financial institutions, and it will be easier for U.S. exporters to sell goods in Cuba. I believe in the free flow of information. Unfortunately, our sanctions on Cuba have denied Cubans access to technology that has empowered individuals around the globe. So I've authorized increased telecommunications connections between the United States and Cuba. Businesses will be able to sell goods that enable Cubans to communicate with the United States and other countries. These are the steps that I can take as president to change this policy. The embargo that's been imposed for decades is now codified in legislation.
All right. Anyway, so cool, man. I don't know if he actually said they're going to lift the embargo. Sounds to me like he's saying they're going to make a lot of exceptions. And, of course, if they're sending ambassadors, that's bad. We don't want that. All we want is an end to the criminalization of Cuba. That used to be one of the Liberty stickers, legalize Cuba. End the embargo, end the persecution of them. You got to agree with dear leader on this one, where if Nixon can go and shake hands with Mao Zedong and say, let's do business with them back in the 1970s, then certainly 25 years after the end of the Soviet Union and the end of world communism, with Cuba and North Korea as the last two holdouts on the planet, we can go ahead powerless, helpless, tiny little countries. Then certainly we can, do the same thing with them. And who cares if it's still Castro, or not? You know, he was going to outlive this policy one way or another, wasn't he? So I think this would be terrible if the American Empire just recolonizes Cuba, like has been the situation in the past, which is why people supported the rise of Castro and Che in the first place. But, anyway, I like the good part of it. I hope, we don't see just, you know, the Cuban government go along with the American gun to their head and sell all Cuban property to American multinational conglomerates with, you know, backed by Federal Reserve, phony money creation, and just literally take their independence entirely away. That could be the bad end of this. But anyway, the American government has no right to prevent Americans from trading with Cubans. Whether the Cuban government has a right to or not is really none of my business. I mean, I don't think that they do, but then again, if they think they do, I don't care. It's their country. I respect their independence. But the American government has no right to interfere. And so they really shouldn't, you know, repeal these policies. They should just go to hell is what they should do. But anyway, you know, close enough. So, okay. Obama gets to be Obama the Great for about an hour and a half before he goes back to nothing but a monster again. But I'll give him a little bit of credit. It's an important step. And he's still talking. I don't know exactly what all changes in the policy we're going to see. And I don't know what all compromises the ruling party there in Cuba is going to be willing to make. But anyway. Celebrate the good part of it anyway. Okay. Now, a couple other things I got to mention real quick. Oh, and by the way, this topic will be covered at length with Eric Margulies later on the show. We're going to talk about Pakistan and Cuba with him there. So that'll be good. Grant Smith in just a minute, and Bob McCarty is going to be on to talk about Jesse Trenadu and the trial. I can't talk with Jesse Trenadu because he's in the middle of this trial. But I can talk to Bob McCarty about Jesse Trenadu in the middle of this trial. Hell yes. And there's some new news there. It's basically just an excuse to get him on the show, this news. It's a tangent. But anyway, so Bob McCarty's going to be on to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing. And then I wanted to mention here real quick. Oh, yeah, I got to say my website, scotthorton.org. I got 3,500 plus interviews there at scotthorton.org. No, really. It's funny. It used to be when you say 900, you go, wow, 900 interviews. Now it's 3,500 interviews there at scotthorton.org. Most of them work. All free for you in MP3 format there, scotthorton.org/interviews. Follow me on Twitter if you don't mind being insulted and reading the F word from time to time, at Scott Horton Show on Twitter. Scott Horton Show. Okay, and then now I want to tell you about this. Yesterday I got an email from a friend. And the email from the friend was along the lines of, hey, man, so you know what? I don't know what I believe anymore. I thought I was some kind of progressive or something, but I don't really know. And I was wondering if you could recommend to me what's some really good, you know, introductory reading to libertarianism, your style. Wow, cool, man. Isn't that great? I love it when that happens. Somebody comes to me and says, what ought to I read about liberty? Well, first of all, Rothbard. Rothbard, 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 Rothbard. Why? Because he's more libertarian than all of you, and yeah. So he's sort of the plumb line. You know, various stages in his life, and not so much at others. But anyway. The very favorite, oh, I'm out of time. Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. You want to know what libertarianism is about? You want to know what the libertarian view of the world is? Read Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty by Murray Rothbard. And now I'm not going to be able to tell you the rest of the list, but. That's the best one to start with, right there. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. CNI stands against America's negative role in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war party's relentless push to bomb Iran, and the roles played by twisted Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia in justifying it all. But they can't do it without you. Support CNI's push to straighten out America's crooked course. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the thing here, man. So, like I was saying, Bob McCarty coming up on the Oklahoma City bombing and Eric Margulies on Pakistan and on Cuba. And then there's a lady wrote this thing about American efforts to build up a Sunni army in Iraq, a new kind of awakening movement thing for the Global Post. And I'm working on trying to get her on the show. But that may or may not happen. But anyway, first up today, we're going to go ahead and get started with the interviews right now. It's our friend, Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. That's IRMEP, IRMEP.org, IRMEP.org. And basically, you know how Leopold is with the FOIA? The FOIA jihad against the government, give me all your documents. That's exactly like Grant F. Smith. Only specializing on the influence of the Israeli government in the United States, well, in their fifth column, in the United States of America, and, you know, that the information, the PDF files on that website are worth all the gold in Fort Knox, which I know isn't much, but still. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Great to be on your show, and it is horrible that a recent FOIA law that was ready to go through in Congress, which would have made it you know, the presumption that we have an open government failed. And so it's going to continue to be apparently as hard as ever to get these things.
Yeah. Well, keep working on that. But, yeah, no surprise there. We're lucky FOIA exists at all. Was that some kind of weird hobby horse of Daniel Patrick Moynihan or something? Is that where that came from?
Yeah, exactly. It was this really
How did I know that? Where did I know that from?
Anyway. Oh, yeah. Well, all the people you have on who are FOIA people. But, you know, basically it would have changed the idea that there's a presumption of openness. It's already been stated in an executive order, but it would have been a lot easier in court and filing FOIAs to say, look, instead of looking at every single possible way you can deny this, why don't you look at all the ways you could actually release it? Because I tell you, it's horrible out there.
Yeah, no, I bet. You have to be a real specialist like you or Jason Leopold or something like that to be able to get it done with any kind of efficacy there. And you know what? I completely neglected to mention in your introduction there before we got off on our FOIA tangent about these books that you wrote, Spy Trade, Divert, Foreign Agents, America's Defense Line, Deadly Dogma, and more, all of them on the Israel lobby in one way or the other and their influence in the United States. And all of them, of course, are available at Amazon.com, at ScottHorton.org/books, in fact. You can find them there, too.
Yeah, and, absolutely. Go through Scott Horton and buy all of your holiday gifts, making sure you buy those books.
All right. Yeah. Thanks.
Divert. Foreign agents. Yeah.
This is ridiculous. This is going from an interview to a commercial, basically. We got to stop it.
Because
it's already basically a commercial in the first place. Anyway, I brought you on because I'm very excited to read that you've got this conference coming up on April the 10th at the National Press Club. Somewhat of a repeat of the conference from last year on reassessing the special relationship between America and Israel?
Actually not. This conference is, you know, the idea is to get out initial information so people can save the date and know this thing is going on. But this one is really focused on the lobby itself. And so, you know, it's focusing on cause rather than effect. And it's going to be a very in-depth look, again, at this constellation of organizations across the United States that are active at every level of government. Trying to, in a coordinated way, implement a lot of these policies, the ongoing economic warfare against Iran, this huge, military aid package that exceeds everything else the United States gives away, all of these new benefits that are included in the new United States Israel Strategic Partnership Act of 2014 that give them new access to weapon stockpiles and sort of a route to visa-free entry. So we're really looking at taking a sharp focus on the organizations, not just AIPAC, not just the ZOA, not just the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, but really all of them. And talking about, really, is this massive amount of foreign policy influence because Israel is such a gigantic asset to the United States, or is it really the result of all of these activities, some of which, as I've documented and that you've mentioned, are quite questionable. So it should be a very interesting gathering.
Yeah. Man, you got to get Andrew Coburn and Jacob Hailbroom, both of those guys, to give talks.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're kind of holding off on announcing who's exactly going to be there. We're going to try and, you know, as good PR and marketing people, string that on for 4 months now. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, now, hopefully. You know, Hailbroom is the guy, I think, who has kind of summed it up better than anyone, I think, to say that, you know, these guys, you know, regardless of Israel, but just going back to the neoconservatives, back to Alcove B at City College in New York and all that in the first place. And they felt so put out by the WASPs that they weren't allowed into the Council on Foreign Relations. They didn't have a say at the table.
Yep.
So they said, screw you guys. We're going to make 20 Council on Foreign Relationses, and then we're going to end up running the Council on Foreign Relations too. And then what are you going to do about it? And that was kind of their whole thing in the first place, like going back decades was this long-term agenda to build think tanks, just as many of them as you can, even if they are all just pieces of paper in Bill Kristol's right-hand desk drawer. Just get as many of them as you possibly can, echoing each other and pretending to be the consensus, and you'll win, and it worked.
Absolutely. It's funny you say that, because a lot of these organizations all share the same address. And so when you really start putting them into a database, it's like, what?
Is Jim Logue, really too, is the master at this one, stuff.
Yeah, he's good. He's excellent. In fact, I think he just bobbed in and out at that last press club event. Well, you were there.
I got to shake Jim's hand. It was great.
So, that's one of the interesting things about the press club. You never know who's going to be there because they work there. And so it's really interesting that you have expertise inside that building that doesn't even have to do much but come down and, start doing it. But, you also had, moderation of a panel on that thing. And that was, it just shows how challenging some of these things can be to stay on track and to try and get things. Get everyone.
Better you than me, man. I'll stay in the audience this time, I think. Yeah. This is really important. I sure hope that, interested people can start, scratching their heads, see what they can do to help promote this thing and get as much attention as they can,
Absolutely. It's Cherry Blossom Festival in Washington, so there shouldn't be any snowstorms. And, encourage people to go to IsraelLobbyUS.org and go to the Twitter feed at IsraelLobbyUS and just, hopefully, be interested and start, looking at the program when we unveil all of these things.
Great. That's IsraelLobbyUS.org. IsraelLobbyUS.org and at IsraelLobbyUS on Twitter. Great. Thanks so much. That's Grant F. Smith, everybody. Appreciate it. Bye. That's IRMEP.org and IsraelLobby.US.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richman, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, Eric Margolies to talk about Pakistan and Cuba today. And I'm still working on Global Post Lady on that Iraq story. But anyway, we'll see what happens. Next up is Bob McCarty. He's at bobmccarty.com. That's McCarty. And he's the author of 3 Days in August, The Clapper Memo, and The National Bet. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Bob?
Great, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. Very happy to have you paying attention to this Oklahoma City bombing case, which means basically you're pulling the slack of every other journalist in America who couldn't give a damn about this. But it's incredibly important to me. It always will be. And you have taken the opportunity of this FBI agent getting himself in trouble. A cop was arrested for something? I've never heard of that before. So there's something interesting right there. But the cop who was arrested has a tie to the Oklahoma City bombing case that's going, Oklahoma City bombing case that's going through the courts right now. Opportunity for you to bring it back up. Opportunity for me to have you back on the show to talk about it. So who is Agent Adam Grant Quirk?
FBI agent Adam Quirk, he's notable in this Oklahoma City bombing trial because he was recently alleged to have engaged in witness tampering with one witness that was supposed to testify during Jesse Trinidad's trial. And, of course, he denied it. The FBI denies it, but that's the same FBI that last month was threatened by the federal judge to be held in contempt of court for not following his orders and conducting thorough searches of their evidence inventory for materials that Jesse Trinidad has been trying to get for more than 5 years now. Mm-hmm. So this FBI agent, after allegedly engaging in witness tampering over the weekend, he allegedly engaged in assaulting his girlfriend in a very painful and ugly sort of way out there in Salt Lake City where the trial is taking place. So you know, either way you slice it, this guy's getting hit, coming and going left and right with bad news.
Well, he's under a lot of pressure right now. Now, I'm sure you've seen all the same emails as I have from the court documents in this case, where there seems to be, you know, I don't know exactly the legal definitions and whatever. That's the other Scott Horton, that's the lawyer. But sure seems like probable beyond the shadow of a something that there actually was some improper communication between this FBI agent and this former FBI asset, if I understand it right, that that yes, you should take every opportunity you can to avoid testifying in this trial. He's not allowed to do that.
No, and that's
I've read his emails saying that.
Yeah, that's what really I think set the judge on fire, because, you know, basically the FBI agent said it'd be best if you take a vacation and don't show up to testify, you know, or else.
Right.
So, you know, what's the or else there, which for citizens of this republic, you know, or else, those are two huge words infringing on your civil liberties.
Yeah. We're talking about a government agent here. It's not just a person talking to someone, which that's still a credible threat, but a government agent making a threat like that is not threatening individual action. They're threatening bringing down the weight of the state against you, an entirely different question, much more dangerous. So, okay, so now get to, and of course, we're having to work backwards in a short amount of time on this story here, but thanks for humoring me. Who is it that Agent Adam Grant Quirk was trying to encourage to not go to court and testify, and why might he be doing such a thing?
The guy's name is John Matthews, and according to the documents that Jesse has presented to the court over so long, he was engaged as an FBI informant back in the days before the Oklahoma City bombing. He was allegedly an informant inside a white supremacist group that some believe has a tie to the Oklahoma City bombing conspiracy. And, you know, whether he does or not, I haven't decided. But Jesse thinks he does, and he wanted to hear this guy testify in court. Because for those not familiar with why there's an Oklahoma City bombing trial, you know, going on now, nearly 20 years after the event took place, is because Jesse Trenadue is trying to find out why his brother was killed in federal custody several months after the bombing, and was trying to get copies of videotapes that would show John Doe number two and possibly others getting out of the Ryder rental truck in downtown Oklahoma City seconds before the bombing. And the FBI, though documents show the FBI had possession of the videotapes, and local officials, you know, testify that they had seen the videotapes that showed more than what the FBI says, more people than what the FBI says were in the truck. The FBI has kept those tapes, denied they exist, even after paperwork showed they did. They denied the tapes exist, even after other witnesses said they'd watched the tapes, and they denied having any knowledge of where the tapes are, even though all records point to the FBI, you know, evidence storage areas. So Jesse's fighting this. He's going to win, I think, in the long run. It's just, you know, it's kind of like legal jihad. How long will the FBI force him to fight? It's going on well over 5 years now.
Well, and I think, I don't know exactly how unprecedented, but I think I read that it's unprecedented that he has now taken a FOIA case all the way to trial, further than any FOIA case has gone before or something like that. And he's suing for the right to search through the evidence lockers himself. I'll find the damn tape.
Right, right. And, you know, he not only is following that line, but he asked the judge, the federal judge, not just a Salt Lake City judge. He asked the federal judge to appoint a special master to oversee, you know, the court's relationship with the FBI, because the FBI has been acting in such an untoward manner and disrespectful manner toward the court.
Right. Yeah. And that's one thing about this judge is he's way out there in Utah, and apparently for some reason has it in his head that he's somewhat independent from the Justice Department and doesn't tend to see things their way for years on end here. Now it's a damn near miracle in this day and age. And I want to get back to what you mentioned there real quick, just for people who have no idea how the Oklahoma bombing has anything to do with this. What you mentioned there about Jesse trying to find out who killed his brother and why his brother, Kenneth Trenadue, the most likely explanation Jesse seems to think, and this also is according to a letter that he got from Timothy McVeigh, and was also J.D. Cash, the investigative reporter's conclusion, that the federal agents must have, it's still speculation, but they must have mistaken Kenneth for a man named Guthrie, Richard Guthrie. And he had the exact same red-headed mullet and upper body build and dragon tattoo and was coming across the border from Mexico in the same kind of red pickup truck. And it was just the most perfect case of mistaken identity possible, where this guy just fit Guthrie's description in such a tight way that the feds must have just convinced themselves that that's who this was. And then it was in their interrogation of this Oklahoma City bombing suspect that he ended up in a fight for his life and lost it.
Well,
seems,
you know,
the most plausible explanation here.
The FBI,
and of course, Guthrie, the real Guthrie, died in his prison cell just a few months later,
right,
of another supposed suicide that they tried to claim this one was too.
Right. They tried to claim he committed suicide after breaking so many bones that I doubt if he could have stood up, more or less hung himself. But and
you're talking the real Guthrie now?
No, I'm talking
Kenneth.
Kenneth, you know.
Right. Okay, I'm sorry. Too many he's. Now, hold it one second. We got to take this break. When we get back, we'll have more with Bob McCarty on the heroic Jesse Trenadue fighting for justice in the case of the death of his brother, Kenneth, and for the truth of the Oklahoma City bombing. And we'll be right back after this. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Bob McCarty. He's at BobMcCarty.com, author of the Clapper Memo. And this article is, well, a short blog entry. FBI agent accused of witness tampering, arrested. Not for witness tampering, as OKC bombing trial continues in federal court in Salt Lake City. Try to make a long story short, all these different crimes within crimes. Part of the cover-up of the Oklahoma City bombing continues to this day, with this FBI agent telling his former asset informant guy by email to not show up in court, even though he subpoenaed to be a witness for Jesse Trenadue in his trial, to get the judge to force the FBI to allow him to go digging through their evidence lockers to look for the tapes that they swear they can't find of multiple John Does with McVeigh at the moment of the attack, getting out of the Ryder truck with McVeigh at the moment of the Oklahoma City bombing attack, because they killed his brother, Jesse's brother, in a possible case of mistaken identity, thinking that he was apparently thinking he was this guy, Richard Guthrie, who may have been responsible, partly responsible for the bombing, and setting Jesse on what Bob called this legal jihad. I guess that's their legal jihad against him. He's defending himself, or they're forcing him to just fight absolutely tooth and nail every step of the way for more than a decade now to get a little bit of truth and justice in the case of his brother and the bombing. And boy, wouldn't that be something, Bob, if we could actually see the videotape of McVeigh and his co-conspirators getting out of that truck that day?
It would be. And, you know, people did see that tape, and they've been interviewed by several authors and other investigators, mm-hmm. you know, put out books about it. But the FBI would rather it be kept secret because it destroys the narrative that has been pushed ever since Bill Clinton was in office, mm-hmm. that this was a homegrown terrorist, i.e. McVeigh and Nichols. It was a homegrown terror activity, and, you know, that's all there was to it. But, you know, if the John Doe number two actually comes out or others come out in that tape, then it tells us that the administration then and really everyone since then has been lying about the truth of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you and I have differed before on the matter of homegrown or not. I've been paying attention to this ever since 1995, and almost immediately after the bombing, other right-wingers, militia types, patriot movement types, the John Birch Society, and all of these people on the, you know, outside of the acceptable Republican conservative movement on the right, they all immediately were saying, come on, it was Dennis Mahan and Andre Strassmeyer did it. Everybody knows that. Basically, every patriot movement non-Nazi was saying it was the Nazis. Everybody knows it was the Nazis. And then, of course, it turns out that the Nazis, they were all compromised by the feds, but that means that the feds were all compromised by them, too. They were all a bunch of informants and flip states witnesses and other people that the feds had made deals with at one time or another. The ATF was going to roll them up, and the FBI stopped the ATF from rolling them up before the attack happened. And so they had to cover it up. And, in fact, in the new book, Oklahoma City by Gumbel and Roger Charles, they got great quotes from members of the Justice Department describing in detail the fight inside the Justice Department over whether we want to just pin it on McVeigh or whether we want to go after the rest of these guys too. And they decided, nah, let's not. And so I know you think that it's Hussein Husseini and the brown pickup truck and all of that. I think the brown pickup truck belonged to the Arizona gold miner, neo-Nazi guy, fellow traveler. And, you know, even when they executed McVeigh, oh, by the way, a neo-Nazi leader was being executed that day, April 19th, 1995. And it was also the anniversary of a previous attempt to attack a federal building in Oklahoma by those same Nazis. And the day McVeigh was executed, he had his head shaved to the skin. And everybody said, oh, wow, that's interesting. It's almost like he's a Nazi or something. They had tried to pin the bombing on the entire American right wing, and especially the militia movement. But really, anybody to the right of Rush Limbaugh was said to be responsible for the damn thing. But when it came to the actual Hitler-loving Nazis who did it, they all got away with it scot-free. And it was because they were all already in trouble with the cops. The cops knew them, and they knew the cops. And so what a messy story to tell. You know what? Let's give them O.J. Simpson instead. They'll eat that up.
Oh, well, that's a stretch, but yeah, I like it.
I'm not saying they made OJ did it. I'm just saying that was the reason nobody cared about the Oklahoma bombing after it happened is because everybody cared about the OJ trial instead. That became the true crime story of 1995 and 1996, as opposed to the Oklahoma bombing story, which if OJ had never done that, and the reporters had had nothing else to do but wonder about what this Carol Howe lady was saying and whatever, we might have seen a couple of 2020 episodes more and seen a difference made at the time.
Well, I haven't read Roger Charles' book, but I did read Jaina Davis's.
See, that's my problem. I haven't read hers, but I have read his. So you and I need to have a meeting someday and read each other's recommended reading, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, Jaina Davis, she pinpoints Iraqis who came over here through asylum, but they were actually members of the Iraq Revolutionary Guard. And, you know, she traced where they lived, the businesses they ran, how they were involved. And, you know, I think it's as credible an explanation as anyone could. And, you know, the guy that really applauded her work was the guy who served as a chief investigative counsel during the Clinton impeachment hearings, a guy named David Shippers, an attorney in Chicago. And, you know,
yeah, but so did the raving lunatic and former FBI director, CIA director under Bill Clinton, World War IV, James Woolsey, who right after 9/11 went to Britain to compare fingerprints to try to prove that Ramzi Youssef was not Ramzi Youssef, bin Laden's man, but was an Iraqi imposter. And this is all tied up with Judith Miller, the lady that hoaxed us into war with all the weapons of mass destruction lies. She was like the mentor to Jaina Davis in putting all this together and implicating Iraq in this. The American Enterprise Institute, guys. You know, is Dick Cheney's wife is the head endorsement on Lori Milroy's book, Saddam Hussein's Unfinished War with the United States, that tries to pull the same stunt and say that Al-Qaeda is just a front for Iraq and did Oklahoma. Come on.
Well, you know, obviously you didn't read, this is, you know, off the subject, but New York Times published a piece just couple months back. But, okay, so there were weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, forget yeah, but those were all leftovers from the Reagan era. That was why the Bush administration didn't publicize them. None of those were manufactured after 1991. All of those were declared and just duds and leftovers from the Reagan era when Saddam Hussein worked for the United States of America and was buying those weapons from our European allies with our tax money.
Well,
so
we could talk for a
long time. None of that verifies a thing that they said about active weapons to manufacture chemical or biological or nuclear weapons anywhere, or a warehouse anywhere full of weapons to use. And we're talking about duds found in the ground that soldiers went, oh, look. But all of it declared to the international inspectors, all of it known by the international inspectors. Same as the uranium that was there under IAEA lock and key. Everybody knew it was there. They later moved it to Canada and everybody said, oh, look, uranium. But it wasn't secret uranium. It was uranium left over under seal, left over from the 80s when Saddam Hussein was a good guy. Fighting Iran for us before we fought him for Iran under Bush in the name of fake weapons of mass destruction. You know that. Come on, right? You remember the last decade, don't you, Bob?
I do, and I was actually in the Air Force at the time we first went to war. So
in the first Gulf War?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know that they discovered his nuclear program after that war, and they completely destroyed it, and that no part of it ever came into existence again after 1991. That's in the Dulfer report.
Well,
while the government was claiming that, oh, look, he's buying these centrifuges for his active nuclear weapons program. Come on, they were lying.
I won't try to argue with you on this because
We got off on the tangent, man. It was supposed to be an Oklahoma bombing interview, but all this stuff about Saddam Hussein at war with the U.S. is just what it is it's a complete and total inversion of the truth. America backstabbed their loyal fascist sock puppet dictator, and they've been killing his former people ever since by the millions now.
Well, you know, you could say that, we freed 4.5 million Iraqis, and then they
freed them from who?
They fell back into their own trap. Well, they were under a dictator named Hussein, but you know, they fell back into their old ways, not knowing how to run a country, kind of like the way our country's being run right now.
We kind of raised the whole place to the ground. It's sort of hard to build up a nation from nothing. But anyway. All right. Well, thanks for the coverage, and I appreciate everybody. It's BobMcCarty.com. The Clapper Memo is the book. Thanks again, Bob.
Thanks, Scott.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, guys. So Marley's going to be on to talk about Cuba in a minute. In a few minutes. I really shouldn't drink Coke while I'm doing the show. Got to rely heavily on that mute button there. All right. I should have let him slide on all that stuff, man. I shouldn't have argued with my guests. And then I went on way too long. You know me, I could argue on and on and on and on and on. Now, I apologize to Bob. Bob, if you're listening, I apologize. I should send him a note. I shouldn't argue about Iraq with the guy. I'm interested in the Oklahoma thing. And I, you know, I don't think Iraq did Oklahoma. I think it was the Nazis. But the more important point is I could have directed the story back to, you know, Jesse and his heroic FOIA war and the FBI's resistance and this, you know, more about what this guy claims he knows as part of the PATCON operation and et cetera. But anyway, whatever. Can't win them all. What's funny is every time I think, oh, man, I don't know, kind of overstepped, shouldn't have done that, always people are like, yeah, that was rad. Nobody ever argues with the warmongers. Should have the warmongers on more, I guess. But not Bob. He's a decent guy, man. Yeah. I should have the bad guys on. Anyway, so the big news is the Cuba thing. Everyone in my Twitter feed is saying, oh, this is just part of the Empire screwing the Russians extra. Ah, I see what you mean. Interesting point. We're going to let Eric Margulies comment on all of that. And also what's going on in Pakistan. He's a real expert on Pakistan for a white guy, you know. And I tried to reach Anand. I never heard back. I don't know too many Pakistanis. I used to would have interviewed Salim Shahzad, but the ISI killed him. I interviewed him one time. I was like, all right, what a great new guy to interview, man. I was getting his book, waiting to get his book before I interviewed him again, so I could interview him all about his book. And then turned out he wasn't alive anymore because Pakistani intelligence murdered him for saying that Al-Qaeda had infiltrated the Pakistani Navy and were making themselves a real problem reporting that. So anyway, but Eric Margulies, man, he's going to be on. He knows lots of things. You can count on Eric. I can count on Eric to comment on anything. I can ask him about Yemen. I can ask him about Mali. I can ask him about Korea, about China. I can ask him all about Eastern Europe, about the Middle East. He really is the expert on all of this stuff, man. He's been there. He has been there. He has reported on. I say, tell me about the communists. He says, I was the first reporter to go and read the German secret police transcript. Or was it the Germans or the Kremlin, the Moscow secret police? I think it might have been both. Anyway, yeah, Margulies, man. So he's going to be on to talk about those things. Okay, so now I don't have an Iraq war guest to talk about Iraq with today, so I'm just going to have to do it myself. This is, This is that. First ground clash between ISIS and U.S. forces in Iraq. This is according to EnglishShafaq.com, S-H-A-F-A-A-Q.com. You can find Jason Ditz has his own write-up at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. The original article here reads, an American force has fought its actual first battle against the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria organization during a counterattack that was carried out by tribal forces and other forces of the Iraqi army near Ain al-Assad base west of Anbar. West of Anbar? Thought Anbar went all the way to Syria. In an attempt to remove them from the base of which included, I guess, translation kind of thing. Yeah? Which includes about 100 U.S. advisors in it. A field commander of the Iraqi army in Anbar province said the U.S. force equipped with light and medium weapons supported by fighter force model F-18s was able to inflict casualties against fighters of ISIS and force them to retreat from the al-Dalab area. So, there you go. We had a few weeks back, well, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks back now, we had Mitchell Prothero's report, remember, boots in the air, American flying Apaches, because it became necessary to beat them back from an advance in the Anbar province. And, you know, the airport is, I think, what, 15 miles west of Baghdad. And then Abu Ghraib neighborhood and prison, that's like another 15 or 20 miles or so. And then Fallujah after that. And Fallujah's been under Islamic State control, or at least major influence, since January. Since long before the fall of Mosul, half a year before the fall of Mosul and the declaration of the caliphate. So, there you go. That's the 6,000-something troops. And, you know, there's been some reports of buildup. I can actually only think of one solid report of Marines being sent to reinforce a base in Kuwait and, you know, apparently getting ready for next spring, I guess. I'm sure there's a lot more of that going on. But it's already starting. It's just like in the Downing Street memos where they say, come on, let's fix the facts around the policy. It's the head of the MI6, Richard Dearlove. It's his notes from a meeting with Tony Blair and George Bush. The Americans have decided they're going to invade Iraq, and the facts are being fixed around the policy. Well, it also says they're debating how to start the war. There's option A, which is the weapons of mass destruction pretext and a giant buildup in Kuwait and a UN resolution and then a deliberate invasion that way. But then there's option B, rolling start. And what we'll do in that case is we'll paint up. This is apparently George Bush's conversation with Tony Blair being reported by the head of MI6. That's Britain's CIA. Richard Dearlove. That, you know, we could paint up a U-2 spy plane in UN colors and deliberately get it shot down. And then say that, see, there he is in material breach. And then we could start the bombing then and start the invasion piecemeal and reinforce later. This would be a way to get the war started sooner. And, of course, they ended up just sticking with option A, even though they never did get that UN resolution. Not that it makes any difference, really. But anyway, so looks like that's what's going on here. The rolling start. Hey, everybody, we're going to send about a few hundred advisors. Remember that? It seems like so long ago. We're going to send about, 600 advisors? Something. Now we're at a few thousand, 3,000, 6,000. Oh, all of a sudden we're going to double the number from 3,000 to 6,000. Oh, okay. And that doesn't count special forces at all. Meaning, I don't think that even counts Rangers, the second tier of special forces like Rangers and Marine Force Recon and those guys. And then it certainly does not count Delta Force and Navy SEALs and all the top tier special forces guys. And it doesn't count the spies, the CIA, and they have their own private army. The CIA has their paramilitary force. And then, of course, you have all the mercs. And then you have, you know, outright just regular rank and file Marines guarding the base as well in significant numbers because of the embassy, I meant to say, but it is the second biggest, or it is the biggest embassy in the world. Rivaled only by the other American imperial base of this era in Afghanistan. That's about the size of the Vatican, as Ron Paul has pointed out. So the war's already on. It's just a rolling start. And I guess you can only fit so many wars in a news cycle. We've got such a war at home now. It's really dominated the headlines. But this thing is on, and there's no force organized to stop them. Sorry. Also from news.antiwar.com, Obama, no safe haven for ISIS. Now, I told you this. The first statement he gave on the White House lawn in front of the helicopter, he said there will be no safe haven for terrorists in Iraq. That's it. Blam. Open-ended, self-declared Gulf of Tonkin resolution by the President of the United States. Not only will we not let the Islamic State be a state, we won't even let it be an insurgency. We will build a rule of law for Western Iraq so that it is no longer lawless Western failed state Iraq where jihadis thrive. No safe haven. Unlimited blank check for another century of war in Mesopotamia right there from his very first statement, and now he's just doubling down. More bad news on the Islamic State war on the other side of this break.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. All right, so a few more stories on the Islamic State war here. And there's so much been going on. I apologize. I haven't been covering this war for you guys enough yet. But this is, I was trying to get on the show today, Susanna George from the Global Post, maybe later in the week. America is building a Sunni army in Iraq to take on the Islamic State. People are always asking me about this, man. They're saying to me, so what's the deal with these guys anyway? So my thing is this. America should do nothing because these guys, the local Iraqi Sunnis, it's up to them to decide who their government is. And right now, they've had the Islamic State foisted on them, but they're the ones most capable of getting rid of them. And if it's their solution to the Islamic State problem, it's much more likely to stick. And when America comes in and intervenes on their side, all libertarianism and morality aside, I'm talking just, you know, talking hypotheticals about different ways the war could be fought, you know, by these guys. Not saying I recommend any sort of intervention whatsoever. I'm saying I don't. But anyway, you're going to understand what I mean. If America intervenes on the side of the guys that they're trying to help overthrow these guys, they're much more likely just to undermine them. Or it's possible, I guess, if they give them enough money weapons that they'll be able to win. But who's they? It'll be the people picked by the U.S., not the people who have most of the grassroots power on the ground to supplant the Islamic State. And so it'll be another dislocation, another malinvestment in the power of people on the ground there in Iraq, if you will, fueled by an expansionary money supply in order to make it happen. And so that means it's a bubble headed toward a bust. So here's the deal with the Islamic State. Everything you hear about what bastards they are is true. They are. They're Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're the guys that you remember 6 years ago. They were doing suicide bombings in marketplaces and killing hundreds of women and children at a time just to provoke the Shia into overreacting against the other Sunnis. That's how terrorism works. Provoke an overreaction. And then to help create the sectarian war. You know, Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and the neoconservatives, they all lined up behind the Ayatollah Khamenei of Iran and his sock puppets, mostly from the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and their Bada Brigade, and fought a giant sectarian war for them. And the Zarqawiites, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq guys, were the perfect mirror image of that on the jihadi side. And they were absolute monsters. And so eventually the local Iraqi Sunnis turned on them in what's called the Awakening, which the Americans try to take credit for, especially David Petraeus tries to take credit for it. But the local Iraqi Sunnis have been saying all along, if you'll just let us patrol our own neighborhoods and let us have somewhat autonomy here and stop fighting us, we'll stop fighting you. We'll work within the democracy. If you stop treating us like an insurgency, we'll stop being one, basically. That was the deal the Sunni imams and local leaders and former Ba'athist commanders and whatever had been offering all along in 2003, 4, 5, 6, all the way through. And finally in 07, Petraeus accepted it and said, okay. After really, they've been fighting Al-Qaeda on their own at different times throughout 2006, the local Sunnis. So, anyway, point being, these guys are horrible bastards. They're not welcome where they're foisting themselves. They have a Hillary Clinton-like immigration policy, which I'm all for in America. I don't care. And I don't know what her stand is. Actually, she's probably a fascist on immigration. They have a Sheldon Richmondian policy on immigration. Everyone, come on the hell in as long as you believe in Islam and you're willing to line up behind the Islamic State. And that's the kind of thing that drives people, makes them angry. I don't know, drives them mad, makes them angry. Being bossed around by an 18-year-old punk who doesn't even speak Arabic because he's from the Netherlands, or, you know, or he doesn't speak your dialect at all because he's from, you know, Libya or Morocco or something. The caliph says, there is no Iraq. Well, you know, the Iraqi people, Iraq has existed. You know, the place has existed for a long, long time. The state has existed for 100 years. And there are a lot of people who, yeah, they think of their land as Iraq and they don't necessarily truck with that. So in other words, the Islamic State's, their brutality and their, disregard for the will of the local population, that's only one of the issues. I've reported on here about how Patrick Coburn reported here about how his sources said the Islamic State came to town and said, we're doing a census of the ages of all the daughters and all the households in this neighborhood because some of our guys need wives. Well, that's a good way to get shot in the head, going around kidnapping people's daughters. Right? You could expect them to burn themselves out. Here's another piece of good news about the Islamic State. They're completely landlocked, unless, you know, things keep up in Syria as they are. Maybe they'll have access to the Mediterranean. If America would stop backing their allies in Syria against Assad and would stop getting in the way of Russia backing Assad, then that would probably be the end of that. But anyway, at least for now, they're landlocked and completely surrounded by enemies. And in fact, there's not a single nation state on this planet that will recognize them and do business with them. You know, when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan in the 90s through 2001, they had recognition from Saudi Arabia and Qatar and I think one or two other countries. No nation on earth is going to ever recognize the Islamic State based out of Mosul and Raqqa under Baghdadi or anybody else. They just won't. There will be no open trade relationship. You know, America has total say over all of this, and they're completely surrounded by people who hate them anyway. Other than the Turks and the Saudis, who kind of favor them and yet are terrified of them and don't really want them around. You know, I guess they'd have them defeat their enemies and then disappear somehow. But otherwise, they've got the Iranian-backed Iraqi government and its allied Shiite militias. You got the Kurds up in northern Iraqi Kurdistan. You got the Turks who don't really hate them, but certainly want to keep them out and certainly have the ability to keep them out of Turkey. And then you have Assad. We're going counterclockwise around the dial here, if you can tell. Then you got Assad in the rump state of what's left of western Syria there. Then you have the Jordanians, who Margolis says they can't really invade Iraq, but they can sure as hell hold their own border. They're American and Israeli trained and equipped, and they know how to fight. They're a real professional army, and they can hold a line in Jordan no problem. The Egyptians, of course, a secular military dictatorship backed by America and Israel there. And then, of course, the Saudis, who, you know, they're double-dealing, backstabbing bastards, but you know, they don't want the Islamic State rising up in Riyadh and Jeddah, I'll tell you that. So they got their own little Islamic State there. I don't think they want one that would actually overthrow them and take away their solid gold airplanes and all their coke and whores and crap. So, you know, they really like stuff, those Saudi royals. Give us stuff, they cry. So, yeah, there you go. The Islamic State doesn't have to be fought by America. If we intervene on the side, if we intervene against the Islamic State, we are intervening on the side, again, like George W. Bush did, which we already are doing, on the side of the Ayatollah in Iran and his sock puppets of the Shiite militias in Iraq, as well as Assad, as well as all the rest of the Islamic State's enemies, and we have no business siding with, who are the Badr Brigade, are just as bad as the Islamic State, only Shiite. And why would we be backing them anyway? Well, the whole thing is, man, is we need a complete non-interventionist policy in Iraq. There is no solution there from us. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State: The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Time again to talk to Eric Margolis. Thank goodness. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing? Oh, I think we're having bandwidth problems over there. Try again. Uh-oh. I'll tell you what. Type into that chat a phone number for me to call yet. Or, actually, you want to try again now? Maybe I got you back. Nope. Okay, that ain't gonna happen. We've got a bandwidth problem with Eric Margolis. Let me see if I can get him to type a phone number to me, and I'll call him, and then, well, I don't know, he's calling back on the Skype. Let's try. Hey! Are you there? Check, check, check. I started to hear you at first there a minute ago, but not on this call at all now. Can you hear me? Yeah, we're done. Okay.
I can hear you perfectly.
Oh, there you go.
I'm here.
There you are. All right. Well, great. Hey, Eric, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm watching these events in Pakistan with shock and dismay, to put it politely. And, You know, it seems there's always some kind of horror show before Christmas.
In Pakistan?
Not in Pakistan, because they don't celebrate Christmas, but at least from our, at the
no,
time.
No, I don't mean Christmas in Pakistan, but I mean a horror show in Pakistan before our Christmas, you're saying.
It certainly is.
Yeah, it is an absolute horror show over there. And so I think the numbers today, the latest I saw at antiwar.com is 160 killed. Almost all of them children, 100 and I don't know how many children were killed. I guess everyone agrees by the Taliban. Now, let me ask you, I had Matthew Ho on the show yesterday, former Marine and State Department official turned peacenik. And he was saying, hey, listen. You know, a lot of this can be chalked right up to American intervention there. There already was, you know, basically the Pakistani Taliban was there, but they had basically autonomy. They had a deal worked out with the central state. You leave us alone and we'll leave you alone. And the Americans are the ones who insisted that, no, you must wage a civil war against these guys under Bush and under Obama both. You must pick this never-ending fight that apparently the Pakistani military only fights half-heartedly, one, because it's hard, and two, because they kind of like these guys and don't really want to fight them anyway. And so all they've done is just made them mad and, you know, stirred up a hornet's nest, but with no raid around. Oh, no, now I got a Skype problem again. I finally was getting to the point where I was going to let Eric talk, and the damn thing dropped him. I was gonna let him talk. Okay, here he is. All right, so I think you heard most of that before I lost you there.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so Matthew Ho is saying America has, in my words, stirred up a hornet's nest, but without a cannon raid, and created this mess. What do you think of that?
Well, I agree with Ho. I hate to keep blaming America for everything, but certainly we have played an indirect role in this horrible situation. I know the area of the Pakistan's, what used to be called Northwest Frontier Agency, very well. I've walked through a lot of it without guards or anything else way back when in the 1980s. And this is a Pakhtun or Pashtun tribal territory. It's really part of Afghanistan because the Pakhtuns there are the same as the Pakhtuns on the other side of the artificial border that divides Pakistan and Afghanistan. The British just drew this Durand line, as they call it, across the area. But in 1947-48...
Oh. Oh, man. Boy, this is frustrating. You know, with Skype, it's a... You know what? I'm about to give up on Skype permanently, I think. It's a compromise that is not really worth it for the sound quality, the trade-off with the reliability and all the feedback and echoes and...
Ooh.
Oh, I think we got him back now. So you left off at 48 and the division of India, I think. Oh, lost him again. God. Eric, are you there? Nope. All right. Well, this is the Scott Horton Show. Type me a phone number. Type me a phone number.
Phone, Scott?
Hey, there you are. Hey, listen, do you know how on Skype to find the place where you can type chat messages back and forth? Could you type me your phone number there? You know how that works on Skype? Where it has a little a chat window. Maybe there's like a little... Oh, now you can't even hear me. Little word bubble. All right. Well, hey, it's live radio, man. I don't care. These things happen. Whatever. I'll tell you a funny story. The Taliban was willing to give up Osama bin Laden. Didn't even have to have a war there at all. All right. Hey, there you are typing. Great. I'm going to call you. Well, I guess we'll try to persevere through this for the rest of this segment. Then I'll call you on the phone in the next segment. Eric, that's all right. I think we're connected now, right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead. You left it 1948, I believe, 48, 49, the partition of India.
In 1947, 48, when Pakistan and India were divided by the British, the state of Pakistan was created. Pakistan's Northwest Frontier Agency, as it was called, the territory, was added onto Pakistan, even though its people were, by history and ethnicity, part of Afghanistan. But the Pakistanis got it, but the provision was that they would join Pakistan reluctantly, provided that they had complete autonomy in Pakistan. No Pakistani army, no Pakistani police, no officials, just a tiny, tiny representation, a few border forts, and some agency officials, as they were known. And I walked through this whole area perfectly safe. The Pashtun tribesmen there ran their own business, and they went on merrily on their own way. All this changed when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, and this sort of back area of the Northwest Frontier Province Agency, as it was known, became a staging area for the Afghan Taliban, who were the first cousins of the other Taliban, the other Afghans just across on the other side of the border, Pakistan. The net result was that the U.S. started speaking, well, sanctuaries, we've got to attack sanctuaries in Pakistan. The same story we heard with Cambodia during the 1970s. And as a result, the U.S. been organizing attacks by U.S. forces, by drones, and by the Pakistani army, which was paid billions of dollars to act as American mercenaries, to start attacking Pashtun villages inside the tribal territory. Our predators and reapers went over, blowing up tribal compounds and killing thousands of civilians. Some militants, but thousands of civilians, including many, many children. And so now, this week, the Pakistani Taliban, which has really very little to do with the Afghan Taliban, they're just really a loose collection of tribes, decided they were going to go and get revenge, which is as Afghan as American, as apple pie as American, go and get revenge against the Pakistanis for killing their children by attacking this school.
Mm-hmm. And now there's just been a recent crackdown in by the Pakistani military. I think even American mainstream media like NBC are saying this was a retaliatory strike for an offensive that was launched in June. Sanford and Son plan means we got to take a break. So let me tell the people, like I failed to do at the beginning of this interview, Eric, that your website is ericmargulies.com. Spell it like Margolis. ericmargulies.com. A great bunch of articles there, especially his last one, Torturers Are Not Patriots, is so great. And his books are War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And we'll be right back after this. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at wholefoodcomplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at wholefoodcomplete.com.
All right, I'm Scott. We're working on getting Eric back on the show. Let me find a funny soundbite to play for you or something. I'm pretty sure the bandwidth problem may be on my end and not his. I hope you guys are hearing me okay. Let's see. Oh, this is always a fun one.
So I don't know where he is. Nor do, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. Saddam Hussein no longer fills fields with remains of innocent men, women, and children. Because we acted, Saddam's torture chambers and rape rooms and children's prisons have been closed for good.
Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly.
Well, it's a proud day for America, and by God, we've kicked Vietnam syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
During these last few months, I've been trained by Al-Qaeda, and I'm weak and materialistic. I told our country and I told the world, if it feels good, do it. I hope you'll join me in expressing fear and selfishness. We will embrace tyranny and death as a cause and a creed. We can be summed up in one word: evil.
All right, all right. So, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All technical difficulties aside, we got Eric Margolies on the line. Plain old telephone service that you can bet your bottom dollar on. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you?
It's nice to be back via old-fashioned telephone.
There we go. All right. So you were talking about how the British made it this way and about this sort of, you know, like a Kurdistan-type situation, this Pashtunistan, which doesn't really exist, which kind of brings up the question about what the hell is America's policy in Afghanistan after all these years? Are they trying to just basically forge a minority Uzbek, Tajik, who am I leaving out? Hazara alliance against the Pashtuns, and then that minority coalition with American backing is supposed to just rule all of Afghanistan forever, whether the Pashtuns and like it or not, and whether the Taliban exists or not. I mean, huh? I don't understand. Really,
well,
what they're doing.
That's what we've done since 2001. We allied ourselves with the minority Uzbeks and Tajiks, who, by the way, were mainly Afghan Communist Party. They were the core of the Afghan Communists. So we allied ourselves with the Communists to overthrow an anti-communist government, which was Taliban. And we're still doing that now. We've just, the latest rigged elections have produced very influential Tajik candidate. The head of the vice president there is a monster, a Uzbek warlord, war criminal. So we're still in bed with the same nasty people. And now, because of this foolish war in Afghanistan, it is having all kinds of nefarious repercussions inside Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. And then now the Pashtuns in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, you know, you say, Taliban, it's really kind of these loose tribal confederations. Well, so can you describe maybe to some degree, ballpark, the relative power? Because it sort of seems like, in a sense, almost to echo of what's happening in Iraq, where you have a tribal system, but then you have this, you know, would-be Islamist state on top of it. And they don't necessarily have to coincide together. It seems like maybe they do coincide together in the Afghan-Pakistan situation more, where at least I've never heard of the Pashtuns having any other representation than the Taliban when it comes to dealing with any outside powers anyway.
Well, there are a couple of other Pashtun...
since the 90s, sorry.
Organizations, the Haqqani group, the Hizbi Islami, which is run by my old acquaintance, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who the U.S. has been trying to kill for years. There are different groups. It's not monolithic, but by and large, you know, what they call the Taliban is really isn't even a standing military force. It's just a bunch of mountain hillbillies, and when they get riled up enough, they grab their guns, and they go in and shoot and fight for a while, and then go back home. That's how things work in that part of the world. War is a part-time practice, undertaking, and they... But they had only adopted the name Taliban to get notoriety from the Afghan Taliban, which I think was a big mistake because their problems and issues and goals were somewhat different from those of the Afghan group.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so now what do you expect to happen as a result of this massacre? Is that going to be proof that they should back off the tribal territories? Are they going to reinvade double now or what?
Oh, no. Well, the U.S. will increase payments to the Pakistani government, which are running over $1.5 billion a year in a dirt poor country. That's a lot of money. They will pay them more to bomb and attack these Pashtun inside of Pakistan. The Pakistani army, very angry now that their children have been killed, are going to redouble efforts to attack. There will be more atrocities and more bombings and more killings. It's just a horrible situation. It's going to inflame the whole Northwest frontier and lead to more fighting. Nothing good.
Yeah. Now, so John Bolton was on TV on the Fox News. I'm trying to watch only Fox now because what the hell, get it straight from the Pentagon, right? So John Bolton is saying, and of course everybody on Fox News knows this, that the lesson of Iraq is you can never leave a place after you invade it. Like Max Boot said about Libya, the only problem is we didn't do a full-scale Iraq-sized invasion and training and purple-fingered everything and all of that and build up a nation and never leave ever, ever, like Japan and Korea. And so obviously this is... at least politically, the thinking behind Obama saying, never mind all that, whatever I said about leaving by the end of this year, it turns out that we're staying for more, and that means combat troops are staying longer. And just like he had made a deal to stay till, 2024, back a couple of years ago, so it's not like we didn't really see this coming, but that seems to be the consensus now in D.C. of the rise of the Islamic State. If only the U.S. Army had been here, this would have never happened. And so, I wonder if you think that's really the policy and how long do you expect that to last?
For Iraq or Afghanistan?
Afghanistan, I guess, first.
Yeah, anyway. Well, I've written a couple of articles on this subject, which call the phony pullout from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I don't think there ever was a real plan to completely pull out of Afghanistan, but simply to make it look like we're reducing troops to almost nothing, like Iraq, where, 5,000 American troops are covertly left inside of Iraq. We had about 5,000 or 10,000 mercenaries. We had 20,000 odd troops just south of the border in Kuwait. So there was, the American presence is not, we're gone, but we're still there. And the same thing will happen in Afghanistan, too, because they know that the minute if the U.S. pulls all of its troops out, the Afghan puppet government, and I underline the word puppet because that's what it is, will be overthrown. And it won't last any longer than the Soviet-imposed puppet government under Najibullah did. So, and nobody in Washington can face a defeat in Afghanistan. The military careers will be ruined. Mm-hmm. The politicians will be asked, well, why did you send our boys in to get killed in a stupid war like this with no obvious benefit to the U.S.? Why did you do it? So nobody wants to admit the bankruptcy of the policy, and so they're going to temporize and keep small amounts of troops there, just enough to keep this puppet government in power.
Right. Yeah, in Iraq, at least they were fighting for not the majority of the people, but the political factions and the militias that had assumed the power of the majority, Shia. So, they're going to keep ruling the capital city anyway, whereas in Afghanistan, they've been fighting for this minority coalition that was on the eve of absolute defeat when America invaded in 2001 and could never be expected to hold Kabul, right? So
that's correct.
It was at least plausible they could get out of Iraq, even though really, it's a complicated mess, but at least it was plausible that, well, we fought for the majority, so at least they can hold the ground that we helped them win, right? Whereas in this case, oh, no chance.
That's right. And for all these neocons who want us to keep troops there, they cannot admit that the war has been lost, or that these wars are lost from the day one, practically. And the whole point is to protect their interests in the Middle East by keeping U.S. troops abroad.
Yeah. Hey, I'm already over time here, but let me ask you real quick if you got a minute for a comment about what's going on in Cuba. On the surface,
sure,
everything looks great, right? It's Nixon goes to China, the end of the Cold War with Cuba, hip, hip, hooray, but not so fast. I don't know. Is it all just part of the new Cold War with Russia? Is it all just a plot to overthrow their government and install another fascist dictatorship under Batista the Fourth or some crap?
Well, you're asking the right person here, because I was in Cuba under Batista, and I've been there all the way through the Castro era. It's about damn time that we recognize and normalize relations with Cuba, a very important Latin country. And the Cubans have stood up to intimidation from us for, you know, half a century. Their country's a wreck. They're dirt poor but proud, and enough, you know, call this off, bring them back into the Western Hemisphere nations.
Sure.
And turn a lot of anti-Americanism in Latin America, switch it off by doing so.
Yeah, see, I totally agree with that. I would have the U.S. government stop doing anything and everything to the Cubans. But, you know, it was pointed out on Twitter immediately that, boy, is this a thumb in the eye of old Putin. And it was pointed out immediately that, you know, an embassy in Havana means a CIA station in Havana. And it's not like libertarianism just broke out across North America here. It's something that the fascist Democrats decided to do. So who knows what it might portend, you know?
Well, not only that, but the U.S. government does not speak with one voice.
Sure,
we just
yeah.
learned this last week of this ludicrous effort by the U.S. Agency for, I think, International Development to secretly promote Cuban hip-hop singers to promote anti-Castro messages.
Yeah, and of course they had that kind of fake Twitter thing that they set up a couple of years ago.
That's right. I mean,
so they've been messing around over there all this time, the spies.
That's so stupid and childish. The U.S. should stop embarrassing itself over Cuba and just set them free.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Legalize Cuba, absolutely. Well, at least some steps forward. I guess we'll have you to help us keep a very close eye on
it. Legalize pot and legalize Cuba.
Yeah, exactly. Legalize immigration, too, I think. Legalize Arabs.
Yeah, that's right. Stop. Okay.
No. Go ahead. You get the last one.
Oh, I just stop treating our African American Americans like Arabs.
Yeah, that too. Indeed. In fact, there was a whole thing. Jews and Arabs say Black Lives Matter, and then and Palestinians too. Boy, it's funny whenever we start talking about who matters. It's hard to argue that anyone doesn't. You can only get away with that if it's just implicit. Well, they're terrorists or something like that. But if someone says, well, yeah, but them and their wives and their kids, I mean, they are human beings, aren't they? Then it's hard to argue that they're not if put to the test, right? But
terrorist children, one reads about them. There were about 500, quote, terrorist, unquote, children killed in Gaza recently.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, on Fox, again, as long as we're over time here, all the hype is about the new movie about the American sniper and what a hero he is. This is apparently the trailer for the TV, you know, certainly it's the Fox News trailer clip that they keep playing over and over again, is the sniper taking aim on this woman because she has a grenade and so therefore has sacrificed her life. No question of who's trespassing on whose property, who's the aggressor and who's the defender. But this heroic American sniper must do what he has to do and shoot this woman in the head.
Fascist propaganda. I just saw a poll that says that over 80% of Republicans support torture.
Oh, man, no, it's worse. I saw one, I think I have it, that says, oh, no, it's not in my torture section, though. No, here it is. New poll shows U.S. citizens in every demographic support torture. Republicans, Democrats, white, black, young, old. And that's from Michael Shedlock's Global Economic Trend Analysis blog being passed around there.
Certainly somebody to be proud of.
Amazing. All right, listen, I've already abused the privilege and kept you over time here. Thank you so much for coming back on
the show. Cheers, Scott, top of the season to you.
Have a good one. Happy holidays.
Bye-bye.
And thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow, y'all.